Hello, everybody. Jake Stanziano, host Jake Gino Podcast here with my co-host, a multi-family mentor, the coach, chef, father, six, and best-selling author, the G-Daddy, Gino Barbogian. How's it going?
Jake, I'm doing wonderful. Ask me why I'm doing wonderful.
Why are you doing wonderful, Gino?
Because we have a Renaissance man on. We have a serial entrepreneur on the show. Somebody who, if I'm looking at his life, it seems as if he gets to a certain level and he just pushes to that level and he gets bored and he goes and finds the next thing to do. And he continues to improve himself. And to me, it's the ultimate growth mindset.
And sounds I'm excited. The definition of a Renaissance man.
I'm excited to speak to him. Yes.
All right. Here's the formal bio. Today's guest began his entrepreneurial journey as a child selling lemonade and shoveling snow. Want to find a little bit more about that? Today, he is focused on business education and as the developer of both Inception Marketing and Business Freedom. So without further ado, Eric Edmes, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here. Glad to be back.
So, all right, shoveling snow. Are we talking Northeast? Where did it originate from? Where are we coming from? Canada? What is this?
No, I was born in South Africa, immigrated to Canada.
Not even close.
Yeah, I became Canadian at 8 and then left Canada at 25, lived in Ireland for a year, England for 10 years, California for 3 years. And now I've been in the Caribbean for the last 15-ish years.
And why the Caribbean? Or is it the Caribbean?
It's both.
Okay.
Because if you live in England for 10 years, then you need to average out your sunlight and then spend 10 years in the Caribbean.
So where is your favorite place to live? If you had to pick a place, what was the best place that you lived in?
You know, they all have different features. I mean, I've lived here in the Dominican Republic now for 12 years. And funny enough, I was thinking about it. It's basically the home that I've lived in the longest in my entire life. And I love the lifestyle here. You know, it's consistent weather, but at the same time, and great people and all that stuff. But at the same time, because I do a lot of professional speaking, I'm traveling around the world. So I do get a lot of variety. I think that if I had to live here full time, you know, without the travel, it would not really work. Living in the UK was outstanding. Culturally, it was amazing. And, I built my first business there. It was fantastic. Also, one great thing about living in London is, you know, Heathrow Airport. It was this hub, incredible opportunity to travel around the world. I will say that if it weren't for the geopolitical climate in South Africa, that would be my home.
Hmm. For those of you that want to learn more about Eric, he was on Dr. Jordan Peterson's podcast. Go listen to him. His story as a youth, being homeless. I don't want to really dive into that because I think in this show, you have so much knowledge. This could be a masterclass in and of itself. And I really want to focus on a couple of things that you've built. I mean, first, your public speaking. How did you become a public speaker? And then I want to really dive into some of the things that we as individuals and as business owners need to do to become better public speakers.
Well, I would offer you a reframe. I would say that I became a public speaker by being born, and I think
say that again. It's cut out. By being what?
I became a public speaker by being born. I've never met a 6-month-old baby that was afraid of public speaking. Like they don't have that.
So you had to go back to the roots.
Well, you know what I would say is that it's not so much a matter of becoming a public speaker, it's a matter of returning to it.
Yeah.
The fact is that everybody was born an effective communicator. You know, if you've ever been on a plane with an 18-month-old baby, did they show any signs of fear of public speaking? Absolutely not.
My 3-year-old's relentless.
There you go. And then your job is to somehow manage that relentlessness in a functional way that allows the child to still feel free to communicate, but starts to learn the social cues.
Direct it without stifling it.
Exactly. Speaking of Jordan Peterson, he says, you know, don't let your children do things that would make you not like them. That's incredibly good advice. I mean, you have to think about it.
Impossible, though.
What's that?
No, no.
Nearly impossible.
Well, you know, I would say it's important because if you're not liking some behavior of your child, you are the person most predisposed to like it. So if you're not liking it, imagine what happens when other people are subjected to it. But the trouble, of course, is that what happens very often with overbearing parents and teachers is that we train it out of them. We make them uncomfortable with speaking. And so everybody starts developing a low-grade fear of public speaking. And so for me, it was a matter of recognizing that that's what happened and undoing it.
Dude, that's an impossible balance. And I know you're going to call bullshit on that, whatever. But if you think about it, Kids talking out, being obnoxious. That's the natural state. Mom, 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 mom. I got three of them, and that is their immediate thing. Mom, and then there's a question, and she'll say, what? Mom, I love you. And there's no question. Like, it's just relentlessness, right? And they're attacking. So it's a very slippery slope, and it's very challenging to balance and direct that where you will like them and society will like them, but they're not like incredibly annoying at the same time. And I love my kids, right? There's no, they're mine, so I will. But I think that's a very, it's easier said than done.
I'll give you one principle that can sort the whole thing out right here.
Yeah.
One, any behavior that you reward will be repeated. So do you want to know why kids go, mom, 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 mom? It's because you didn't answer them the first time. And that
so that's why they're not saying dad.
There you go.
I'm doing it, guys. I'm doing it.
The point is that children are little AI units that are trying to figure out how to get what they want and need from the universe. And you are their first punching bag. You are their first place to practice. So I'll give you a great example. In my kitchen over here, when my little girl was about 3 years old, I was cooking with her. She's sitting on the counter. She loves to do that. Then I suddenly realized, you know, she hasn't had anything to drink for a while. And I'm going to go to the fridge and I'm going to get her a little bit of watered down pineapple juice or orange juice or something. Not so sugar, but a little, just a nice hydration. As I start walking to the fridge, she goes, I want a juice. That moment made it impossible for me to give her juice. Because in the world, that's not how you're going to get a pay rise. That's not how you're going to raise money. That's not how you're going to get time off work. That's not how you're going to get a date. You're not going to get anything like that in the world. So if I give it to her after she asks like that, I'm teaching her that that's a functional way of getting her needs met. So instead, I turned around, I'm sorry, sweetie, I can't. And she lost it. She had a temper tantrum. She's like, oh, and now I don't want to reward that either. I had to take her and put her on the floor because I thought she was going to hurt herself. And I put her on the floor and I just sat with her. I didn't touch her. I just sat with her and let her get all the emotion out. And I said, my sweet little girl, I want to give you the juice. I just want you to learn how to ask for it in an effective way. And she looks up at me and she goes, sorry, daddy, can I please have a juice today? And I got her the juice. If your kids are doing stuff, anybody's kids are doing stuff on a repeated basis, it's because it works.
I had the same thing this weekend with Ninja Turtles. We're leaving for a walk and he wanted to bring two Ninja Turtles so they could fight each other on the walk. And my wife had already said no. I didn't hear it. You know, and then I said yes, and then so there's this weird back and forth, and then they're like, it's fine, whatever. And he turns around and gives me this shit-eating grin and starts laughing at me because he got his way. And it was like, nope, put him down. And you know, he lost same shit, same exact shit.
Love it.
For a minute, and we moved on. He got over it. It's fine. So, but don't think he's gonna be rubbing that one in dad's face again, right? So,
Eric, you say resolve the past, handle the present, and prepare the future. Can you explain that? Because I think some of us, when you're resolving the past, a lot of the actions you're taking today are unconsciously going from your past, how your parents treated you, the things you heard about money, the things you heard about fear. And it really, I think, dovetails into what you're talking about with public speaking. Something might have happened when you were younger, you were bullied, you were just made fun of, and then all of a sudden you shut yourself down.
Yeah, that sort of trifecta comes from a talk that I did many years ago in Mykonos, Greece at a biohacking conference. And I was just talking about emotional management. And it's a principle, or it's this, let's call it a methodology that I call the hindsight window. And basically, the idea is that when an adverse event takes place, there's usually a window of time before you can reconcile that adverse event. You got fired, you're pissed off. But the question is, how long are you in victim mode about that? What do you one day wake up and go, Jesus, thank God I got fired? And so in the hindsight window principle, the moment you say, thank God it happened, you close the window. The moment you have appreciation and gratitude for the event, you've closed the window. But if the window is open, then what's going to happen is you're going to start having beliefs about the world informed by that window. In other words, if you have a bunch of things that you resent and regret and are angry about and have guilt and shame about from your past, you're going to naturally assume that the future is going to be bumpy. Whereas if you can quickly resolve and close those windows, you will begin to recognize that everything in the world that ever happens for you is, or to you, is actually happening for you, especially when it doesn't feel that way. So what does that mean? Well, it means that, you know, when you're fired, say somebody gets fired, you're fired, immediate response, adrenaline, anger, fear, you know, all that stuff comes up and it's a major problem. But I know people that will hold on to that for like 30 years. Yeah, my life would be totally different if that bugger didn't fire me, right? Well, hold on now. I see that you're in a job that you feel quite fulfilled about. I'm thinking, yeah, firing you was a dick move, maybe. Maybe it was. But looking at your life today, aren't you kind of glad? And what's amazing is some people can logically go, well, I can see that, but I'm still mad about it because of his intention. Like, hold on a minute now. You got to take the good with the bad. And the minute you can appreciate those things, like Viktor Frankl says it, when you can assess the right and functional meaning for the events of your life, then everything changes. And that's resolving the past. Now, handling the present, well, how about this? Could one of you fire me? I'm an employee. You've been working with me for a while. It's not taken. Could one of you fire me?
Yeah, I got it.
Jake would love this. You've made Jake's week, actually.
I don't love it. But Eric, honestly, there's been a lot of issues with your attitude at work. Your attendance has been shit. And honestly, the team just doesn't like you. They think you're a prick. Eric, this is a Donald Trump moment. You're fired. How's that, guys?
Thank you so much. God, Jake, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. Like, here's the truth. You're right. I don't know why I haven't been on. I'm normally like so motivated.
Suck.
And it's been bad. And I want to thank you right now for firing me.
Now, life's going to be better. Honestly, endless opportunities out there, Eric. Fly.
Honestly,
spread your wings.
What's your reaction if somebody responds like that to getting fired?
Thank God.
You're blown away. But there's also a part of you going, shit, maybe there's something about this person I didn't understand.
But that never happens.
That's not the point, Jake. That's the point is that it never happened.
Meaning, and this is an egotistical statement, but meaning that like when we have let people go in the past, we've never got that response, meaning that it was probably the right move. If I would have gotten that response, we might have said, whoa, wait a minute, pump the brakes. I'm missing
something.
That's
my point. That's
exactly
the point right there, is that if that person demonstrated the capacity for closing windows instantly, you would know they were coachable and you'd be able to move forward with them somewhere.
So much of it is awareness and how, you know, they're being seen, right?
Thank God. I mean, we've known for a while there's been some tension between us and we're just not addressing it. And dumping me is probably the best way for us to address it right now. I guarantee you the dumper at that point is going, what did I just do?
It's my fault too.
What,
yes.
What we're kind of getting at here is that if you learn to close those windows, you don't have to live with the long-term emotional trauma about it. And then, of course, it translates to how do you handle the future? Well, you know right now, most people know right now what kind of shit triggers them. So you prepare for it. You do what you can. I used to have terrible problems with road rage. I get really mad all the time. And then I put a trigger in place that made it more fun. I was living in England, so I put red and yellow cards in the visor. And so now when somebody cut me off, instead of giving them the middle finger or yelling at them, I'd show them a red or yellow card. Made the whole thing fun. No longer had to have that anger every time.
Is that how you start to close the windows? There are other things that you can do to help close those windows?
Yeah. Well, in that case, you're preventing the window from opening in the first place. Mm-hmm. You're saying, you know, I'm driving along and somebody cuts me off. I yell at them. I get mad at them. And then I have all that adrenaline for my next meeting. On the other hand, and this truly happened. I was driving along. A guy did a U-turn in front of me in England, did a U-turn right in front of me, and he couldn't fit into the next lane. So I had to slam on the brakes at speed. Clearly, this is a road rage incident that's justifiable, isn't it? I mean, what he did was wrong. I was driving a convertible. I think to myself, is that a red or a yellow card moment? It's clearly a red card moment. This guy's got to be ejected from the game. And I stand up above the roof, and I show him the red card. How does he react to that? He laughed his ass off. And all the people in the cars beside us that saw it all happen because they heard my rubber screech when I stopped, all of them are laughing their butts off, and so am I. And I get to my next meeting with no adrenaline, no fear, no window even opened.
Is it a lack of self-control, though, even having to hold up the red card?
No.
No, I'm not trying to be rude about this, but is it a lack of self-control that you even have to hold up the red card? And like,
You could argue that. Yeah, you could argue that. But if you talk to somebody who experiences a road rage, it's instant for them. It happens and it's instant. They're like yelling, they're raising the finger or what have you. So what I was doing is inserting something called a pattern interrupt. I was saying, all right, I need to take some action. But, you know, the other version.
Do you still do that to this day or no?
No.
Okay,
no.
So there's been an evolution. I think, and I guess I'm self-identifying with what you're saying, because when I, you know, we would... my wife and I were kind of working out of White Plains, have to drive into the city some days, right? And I experienced that, and since we moved to Tennessee, that was one of my issues, right? I really had a problem with the traffic. But since then, I don't really drive that much anymore, but I feel like I've had an evolution, and I have more self-control. So I think that could initially be a way to get out of the rut, but over time you hope to develop more self-control and not even have to go there,
I think
right?
I can explain it in a very straightforward way. We describe in our various coaching practices, we describe something called the Frankl moment, obviously named after Viktor Frankl. Now, Viktor Frankl said something to this effect that between stimulus and response, there is this moment. And it is in that moment where you assess meaning that you create all of your personal liberty as a human being. Now, the trouble is that many of the things that happen to us at a limbic level. They happen so quickly that inserting that consciousness is almost not possible. So in the case of road rage, for many people, they're driving along, somebody cuts them off. They don't think to themselves, wow, that really made me mad. I'm going to yell and scream at that guy. It just happens. It just happens. Some people snap at their kids. It just happens. So you could say to them, well, you should just be more conscious about that. And, you know, you could just stop it. Or you could be practical about that and say, is there a way to insert consciousness, to inject consciousness? And so in the case of road rage, if you take somebody who lives in a country like England, where red and blue cards are universal, you hand them the red and blue cards, they're now driving along, somebody cuts them off, and the instinct starts to come up, and they go, oh yeah, but I've got my red and blue cards. Pattern interrupt. You've sent their thoughts down a different neural pathway, and you've given them the opportunity to inject consciousness into the situation. And this works whether you're talking about breaking people's food rules or their procrastination habits or their road rage.
Somewhat sold. I think it's the beginning of further growth, but I'm somewhat sold on it.
I mean, Eric, there's so many different ways I want to go to, but I'm a pizza guy. I am in the kitchen. I'm hiding, and I want to get back to this public speaking. What are some of the things that I can start doing to be able to, I guess, unleash my inner self, unleash, you know, my story, and overcome that fear?
You know, there's a lot to unpack here, but I'm going to put to you that there are some psychological strategies, there are some physical strategies, and there are some tactical strategies. So from a psychological perspective, I would say this, that let's say you have social anxiety and you're basically afraid of public speaking and you're in a movie theater and you notice that, and it's a movie theater that's like on a slope, and you notice that there's water running underneath the seats. Like there's clearly some plumbing problem and there's a water. You have a fear of public speaking. You know, you're probably going to just like lift your feet off the floor. And then if it gets bad enough, you'll kind of maybe nudge the person next to you and go, hey, look, there's water, and you'll leave. On the other hand, if you see that there's a fire, you're going to stand up and say, fire! Like your fear of public speaking is going to be gone, right? And that's because the level of passion you have for the message that you want to get out into the world, that the level of that passion will help you to overcome your concern. In fact, if you think about it, let's say you have some groundbreaking, just some phenomenal groundbreaking idea or strategy to share with people, and you let your fear of public speaking prevent you from sharing it. How selfish would that be?
Mm-hmm.
Consider my company, WildFit. I have helped literally over 100,000 people in 100 countries completely radically change their relationship with food, reverse diabetes, lose weight they've never been able to lose, have babies they never thought they could have. And it was because I knew some things about evolutionary biology and behavioral psychology. Now, if I had allowed my fear of public speaking to prevent me from recording that program and going out and promoting it, there would literally be hundreds of thousands of people today still in pain so that I could avoid my 15 minutes of shame on stage. So the first thing is like, if you have an important enough message, it'll help you overcome it. There's a word we have for this. It's called scariosity. And it's a word that was invented by my girlfriend. One day she goes, I have scariosity about that. And what does that mean? And she goes, well, you know, it's scariosity. And I'm like, you saying it again over and over again does not make it a word. Like, you know, she's from Estonia. They make up words in English. They're good words, though. And so she goes, well, what do you think scariosity is? And I said, I don't know, a combination of fear and curiosity about something. Goes, see, it's a word. So I immediately look it up to see if it's a word. It's not. And now I own the .com. There's nothing
and
there
it's
yet.
It's in the Urban Dictionary now too.
The point is that there comes a point in your speaking career where your scariosity balance shifts such sufficiently that you walk up on stage, where your fear becomes subjugated to your passion. And that is huge. That's what happened to me. I became so passionate about wanting to help people with their health that the fear wouldn't stop. So that's the psychological side. Then there's the physiological side. I mean, this is pretty straightforward. If you focus on something, you will make yourself fearful. If you gaze at things, you will make yourself relaxed. So what do most people do? They walk up on stage and stare at the audience. Well, staring at something is about focus, and it raises adrenaline and cortisol. gazing at the audience, you'll soften. So too breathing. If you don't breathe or you breathe very shallowly, you produce cortisol and adrenaline, not so functional. If you take deep lung-filled breaths, you clear out adrenaline and cortisol and you'll feel safer. And then the third piece is just tactics. Like if somebody can show you how to launch your talk really effectively, if you know for certain your first 3 minutes and you know for certain how you're going to end, the middle will take care of itself. I just did a workshop for the last 3 days online. We had a couple hundred people on learning how to write speeches. It's called the One Talk Workshop at Speaker Nation. And we don't talk about fear of public speaking. That's not what the workshop's for. It's not about storytelling. It's about speech writing. But at the end of creating their first speech, I said, how many of you now feel like your nerves are basically obliterated because you've got such a good model? Done.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you focus on with speaking? You talked about, as far as focusing, have you also talked about as far as vocal tones, as far as pausing, pacing, elevation? What do you think are some of the really important things that you need to be able to deliver a message?
Yeah, absolutely. What I would say about that is that there are some of those things that you should focus on, but here's the deal. You can become a very good speaker by learning about vocal use, analog marking, stage use, facial expressions, eye contact, stage anchoring. How to use slides effectively. There's some tactical things that can make you a good speaker, but none of those tactical things can make you great. None of them. And the ultimate danger in the world of speaking is getting trapped at good. Many people get trapped at good. And the transcendence from good to great happens for a different reason. It's not because you learn the techniques. It's not because you learn the strategies. It's because you did the personal development work that made it possible for you to be authentically yourself on stage. That, combined with those strategies, will make you outstanding. That's what you see when you see a Wayne Dyer, a Tony Robbins, a John F. Kennedy, a Winston Churchill. That's somebody who has the skills, but also is willing to be themselves and self-expressed.
You have something in your Speaker Nation called the charisma pattern. And I'd love for you to go over this with Jake, because I think Jake comes on a little too much with visual early on and maybe should come on with kinesthetic. So can you persuade Jake and say, hey, Jake?
You gotta tell me what that stuff means first.
Or I may be wrong, Eric. I don't know. Can you just describe this? I think it's so important because it lends.
I think it's one of the best things about your podcast.
Why is that? What is that?
It creates a little fun and drama. All right. So I'll explain the charisma pattern and I'll explain why Jake is probably right about a third of the time and you might be right a third of the time relative to this conversation. So the charisma pattern is based on the idea that any given audience has a variety of people that are on a spectrum of communication frequency. Some people prefer their communication to be more feeling-based or kinesthetic. They say things like, oh, that sounds really good to me, and they speak quite slowly, deliberately, and they just have a different energy about them. And then you have another group of people that are on the spectrum of like sort of auditory communication. They like a predictable cadence and very clear enunciation. They would like a perfect talk like the one that you would get if you practice at Toastmasters. Like right there in the middle, very calm. Not bad if it's going to be, as long as it's less than 15 minutes. Otherwise, it's going to put people in a trance and put them to sleep. And then the third frequency would be visual. And visual is louder, faster, more intense, and it involves words like destiny and vision and picture this. And so in your audience, all of these people are there. They're all there. So immediately, most speakers always lose 66% of the audience because they speak in one modality. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many times have you guys been to a conference where fully 50% of the speakers frankly sucked? Like they just were boring. Content might have been great, but flatline emotionally. A lot of that has to do with that they were speaking to one group in the audience, not everybody. So the first thing is, in this charisma pattern conversation, is to recognize that a roller coaster of emotion is better. Because if I slow down and I say that like that, it lands differently. But then if I speed it up and say that a roller coaster will allow a full range of emotional expression, then I'm satisfying all of the different needs that are in the audience and not staying with any one of them long enough for the rest of them to get lost. But then that raises the question, which gives birth to your question, and that is, where should I start? I mean, where should I start in those three? Well, I will put it to you this way. In a normal audience, if you start visually, you will hurt the kinesthetics physically. They will feel offended, and I don't mean offended in the risk offense kind of way. I mean, they will feel abruptly assaulted by your volume. If you walk out there and go, all right, everybody, we're going to make it happen. And like, change your destiny. And like, all the kinesthetic people are like, holy shit, does anybody call the police? There's a crazy person. So you can't start there. And even if you start auditorily, even then the kinesthetics are like, Jesus, this is way too fast. It's too loud. The joke is that if you start kinesthetically, if you start low energy, if you start sweetly, you don't piss off the auditory and visual people. You just don't get them. They don't even notice you've started. They're not offended. You're just not relevant. But then you can warm it up. So you start kinesthetically, you warm it up, and then you take it to visual. And this pattern, I didn't invent it. I don't even know where the name charisma or charisma pattern comes from, but I can tell you who used it.
Tony Robbins. Oh, shit.
Tony Robbins, in some cases, he uses it, but he will use it inside. He doesn't start with it, and I'm going to come to that in a minute, but at least not in my experience. Martin Luther King used it. And one of the reasons that we don't know this is that we see clips. So everybody knows Martin Luther King saying, I have a dream! But that's the visual peak that he arrived at. They don't know. They haven't watched it. They didn't pay attention to how he started off by saying, look, I have a dream, you know? I have a dream of little white and little black kids playing on the streets in harmony together. I have a dream of this commitment to social justice. I have a dream. I have a dream. Bam! They just show the clip. I'm gonna say something that's gonna get you guys a bunch of horrible fan mail, but look at Adolf Hitler. I mean, what we see in his videos is the little mustache and keeps hoping it's gonna fall off. But here's the thing, what they didn't show you is that he started way down here calm.
Yeah, and read the text, right? Get it transcribed to actually hear what he's saying. And it's like, it kind of sounds like shit you're hearing today a little bit. It's kind of freaky, right?
So especially but even in 1925 when he wrote Mein Kampf, he wrote in there that oration was the most powerful form of influence. That okay, the pen is mightier than the sword, but the microphone is mightier than the pen. He knew that back then, and he used the charisma pattern to do terrible things.
And I think cocaine, right?
Well, a little amphetamine was also very supportive.
Well, cocaine and inflation talk, and it worked for a little bit. And Gino, I just want to say this: I think he just described the Venn diagram, the third, the third, the third.
Yeah, and Jake, you know what's good for you? You can still scream, so it's okay. All right. Can still scream every now and again. That's the good thing.
Let's go back to Jake for a minute. Based on you said that you think he starts too strong. So I was getting ready to do my second event with Tony Robbins. I'd done an event with him in Fiji. It had gone very well, so he booked me for a bunch more events. So now I'm speaking. Now I have to follow him. He's not an easy act to follow,
what
I guarantee
a dick,
you. And I think it's
Tony Robbins.
One of the moments when I realized I might have some talent. I didn't hear that. What was that?
I said, what a dick that Tony Robbins, making you follow him.
He has been one of the greatest gifts of my life. That's just the fact of the matter.
I agree.
But anyway, yeah. One of the moments that I began to realize that maybe I had some talent in this area is that when they booked me every time to be the speaker who followed Tony. That's the toughest slot to fill. As I prepared to go on the stage in Melbourne, Australia, somebody came up and said, Eric, you can't run that soft Canadian open you do, that soft open. Like you can't do that with Tony's audience. You got away with it in Fiji because it was an intimate event, but you can't do it here in Melbourne. It won't work. Now, here's what's going on. Any given audience has a frequency that they are at as you walk in the room.
Gotcha.
Tony has taken those people to global thermonuclear visual mode to walk onto the stage. So if I walk on and I try to be all soft and kinesthetic and run a charisma pattern, I'm going to lose them. So the real issue of the charisma pattern is to meet them where they're at and pace and lead them through the cycle.
So you got to start off hot then. And is this the point where you can do the Tony impersonation for us? I've been waiting. I'm wanting to ask. Come on. This is how it finishes before you get on stage. So you got to take us from Tony finishing to your kickoff.
I'll tell you a funny story.
Oh, man, I thought I had it.
And it might have an impersonation moment in it. So basically, I get invited to come and speak at this event in Fiji. And the only reason I'm invited is because they couldn't find anybody else. They didn't want me out of preference. It was like quite literally they needed somebody because my very good friend Chet Holmes had passed away and they needed somebody to fill for him. They had 11 days notice and Chet had always spoken highly of me and nobody else was willing to do it. So they invite me. So off I go to do this thing. And then Tony, I'd met him years before, but not that he would remember me. And his team comes and says, Tony wants to meet you in the hallway briefly before you go on stage. I'm like, okay. So I go out into the hallway, and this is me talking to Tony Robbins.
It was like Andre the Giant, right?
He's very. I'm not so short, but he's pretty bloody tall. So anyway, he goes, "How are you feeling about your presentation?" And I go, "Well, 11 days notice. You want me to use Chet's slides? It's not my talk." I said, "You know, it's not the most." He goes, "Well, you could sound a lot more confident." Hold on. And I remember what Tony had said. Nobody in the history of calming down has ever calmed down because you told him to calm down. So again, rapport. I don't go, "Oh no, but Tony, don't worry. Everything will be fine." Instead, I just step into the rapport and then I go, "Look, Tony, I get it. I get it. I could be more confident. Let me tell you something. The reason I'm here and none of your other speakers are here is because I'm a business owner, not a business operator." This is his language. And I go, "So while it might not be exactly the talk that you're expecting, it's going to be fantastic." And he goes, "Well, all right then." So now I walk back to my seat and I'm like, I'm shaking. I'm like, "Did I just do that? What the hell just happened?" Then his team says, "Listen, Tony's going to stay in the room for like 15 minutes. And because he's got a very busy afternoon. And so here's what's going to happen. 15 minutes into your talk, there's going to be one of two outcomes. One, he's going to walk up and thank you, take you off the stage. And I'm supposed to be on for 3.5 hours, right?" So he said that at 15 minutes, he might walk up and if he's not liking it, you're gone. Holy pressure cooker. The other outcome, the one you want, is that he's going to just get up and leave the room because he's got a busy afternoon. And that shows that he trusts you with his audience. And I'm like, all right, in my head, I'm thinking, hell no, man. I want the man to stay. I feel like if I really rock this room, maybe I've got an opportunity with him in the long term. So I don't want him to leave the room. No matter how good I am, his team will never be able to convey that to him the way it would if he saw it. That's what I'm thinking. So quickly, I rearrange my talk to put a story that I know he'd like into the beginning. It's going to be at 2 hours. I bring it right to the front. So now, Tony says to his team, "You know what? I kind of like that guy. I'm going to introduce him myself." Up to now, he had said that he was not introducing me because he was afraid it was going to be a train wreck. So this is an event for a bunch of Chinese entrepreneurs, private event, about 150 or 200 very, very wealthy, very influential Chinese business owners. And so the translator was going to introduce me. So Tony's team goes to the translator and says, "Where's Eric's bio, his introduction?" They go, "Oh, we translated it to Chinese and then we threw it out." They're like, "Well, we need it. Tony needs it." They're like, "Well, just translate it back." I don't know if you've played that game, translating stuff to Chinese and then trying to put it back to English. Especially when there's numbers involved. So they translate it back, they give it to Tony. Tony, I don't know any of this, by the way. I found out later. So I'm sitting there and I'm like about to do my first, and I have not been on a stage for 3 years. This is my first talk in 3 years. Like I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. I feel like a go-kart driver that's just been asked to step into the Formula One. Just go for it. So I'm sitting there a little bit like, holy crap. And then Tony goes up on stage and he's like, he's finishing up his section. He goes, "And now you guys, for our next speaker, I'm so excited. I'm so excited because he started his first business when he was only 9 years old." It's like, no.
It sells.
I started my first business and sold it 9 years later. Holy crap. And that was the energy that I had to go and start the talk with. But it was one of my favorite Tony moments.
So you came out swinging then?
Well, I came out swinging and I told that story in the beginning and Tony stayed in the room for 3.5 hours. He did not leave.
Excellent.
Jake, before we go to the short answers, last question for Eric. You wrote the book, The Evolution Gap. What made you write it and where can people get a copy of the book?
Yeah, The Evolution Gap is what I would consider to be life's work. I mean, I just published this book, Post-Diabetic, which is about the reversal of pre and type 2 diabetes, which is probably one of the most significant problems facing the world today that nobody's talking about. The American budget is $800 billion a year. Diabetes will cost America $400 billion this year. Like, think about that, right? But the joke is that post-diabetic is or I should say diabetes is a symptom of something that we call the evolution gap. So what made me write the book is, first of all, a very primary question, and that is we are living in, as far as an individual person's life goes, we are living in demonstrably the safest, easiest, and most secure times in history. The fact that we get to sit around and watch TV when we want, that's a bloody new idea. You know, 3 generations ago, you didn't have time for that. Life was dangerous. You had to be working. You had to be plowing the fields. You had to make stuff happen. If you ask the average person today how many times they've faced death, most of them have not. Or if they have, it's like, well, this bus came really close to my car.
I was going to say road rage. Yes.
Yeah. You know, no, but if you ask people, I mean, I faced death. We were on a plane that started diving at the planet and oxygen mask dropped. We were facing death. I was in a casino in the Bahamas when four men with assault rifles walked in and started shooting. I was facing death. Most people won't really face death until they die. But if you go three generations back, many of them faced death multiple times before their first death. And then if you go another three generations back, they were experiencing it annually. And if you go another three generations, it's a daily reality. Today, we have full food security for most of us. I recognize there's still some poverty, but poverty levels are lower as a percentage of the overall population than they've ever been. We are living in the safest, best times in the history of ever, and we have more addiction. We have more checking out. We have more psychiatric problems. We have more anxiety, more depression, and more suicide than ever before. Why? And I would put to you that the reason why is that we changed our environment so quickly and so radically that our biology couldn't keep up. And so we are running a bunch of Paleolithic emotions and instincts and cravings and desires and behaviors in this unbelievable technological Neolithic time. And the mismatch is painful to us. And so the book is about helping people identify where the gap is disrupting their quality of life and then how they can first find natural solutions to that and then secondly find modern technological solutions to it.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was genius example of the charisma pattern right there. That was so beautifully done. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
All right, Dave, let's take a quick time out here from our sponsor.
Now, we have had a great run in multifamily, going from zero units to over $250 million in assets. That's over 2,000 apartment deals that we've been able to purchase through our framework, Buy Right, Manage Right, and Finance Right.
Now, Jake and I, we created the Jake and Gino community back in 2015. We launched our first book, Wield Our Profits. And since then, our students have closed over 60,000 units. That's over $4 billion in assets they've been able to close over the last 6 years.
And that's why this community has been so successful. We call it results-based education, and we pour back into the community everything that we've learned on our journey from zero to 2,000 units and all our systems and scale that we use on our very own property management and investing company.
Jake, I love that. It's not just education, it's implementation. So what I want you to do, click on that link down below, apply to work with our team, see how we can help you on your journey in multifamily.
All right, we are back, and we're going to stay with food for a second because it's spit water. It's, and I want to get your take on this because the IG, the Instagram, the shorts are telling me that tobacco in the United States, big tobacco, purchased the food companies and essentially made them as addictive as possible and cheaply produced as possible. So I want to get into the wild fit because I didn't know about this and it sounds really good. So maybe just give us your take and opinion on, the modern food supply and exercise and we'll weave in diabetes. And this is like 15 questions in one. And really, is the cholesterol that big of an issue or is this that and a bunch of bullshit? So I just gave you 34
wow.
questions. Let's go
Dude.
Through them all here.
You want me to do our full 90-day program in 90 seconds? Okay.
Just say yes to all of it. I'll accept it.
Big tobacco. You have to understand how unbelievably manipulative and disturbing big tobacco has been. There came a point in time when they realized they couldn't get women to smoke. And the reason that women wouldn't smoke is that women have an instinct around tidiness. Not all of them, but most of them have an instinct that they don't like being dirty. Men are okay with being dirty. They're willing to go work in the fields and dig ditches and get dirt under their fingernails. But women, on the whole, don't like that. So you can imagine that in the early days of smoking, women would not want to stink like that. You know, they wouldn't have wanted to stink like that. It would be dirty for them and they wouldn't do it. So of course the tobacco industry, they build a body of work based on a guy that was heavily influential in the Nazi campaign and around crowd psychology and what have you. And they ended up doing a bunch of research and they said, what's going on for women in America right now? And of course there's a variety of things, suffrage, women's lib, and the desire for voting and equal things were all starting to come up as a big component. Birth control had come along. And so women no longer like had to go through pregnancy. They could go have a career. All this stuff was starting to bubble up. And they said, if we can attach cigarettes to that movement, then women will smoke. Well, no. Well, yeah. And so Virginia Slims, you know the ad as soon as I say it.
That's where I was going there. You're going to be skinny if you smoke ciggies.
Yeah. From a long way, baby.
Maybe put a white glove on. with a little plastic at the end of it.
Better. They put a woman in a pair of jeans, which were work clothes. They put a men's white shirt on her. They put some dirt on her face because dirty's cool. And then she had a thin cigarette, so it's still feminine. And she said, and the caption said, "You've come a long way, baby." In other words, cigarettes are proof of your escape from the patriarchy. I mean, it was unbelievably manipulative. And soon, more women were smoking than men. They doubled their market. Now, let's go even another level of how I'm going to share it. I don't know if you've ever thought about this before, but there are two ways to jury tamper. The one way is against the law, and that is where you find out who the jury is, you find out where they live, you blackmail, extort, threaten, bribe in some way to get the result you want. Now,
so
we know
the CIA
partook in those types of activities, but that is not the most effective way to jury tamper. A much more effective and legal way to jury tamper is to change the feeling about something in the public mood. And so the tobacco industry started referring to lung cancer as a lifestyle disease. Because you see, if it's a lifestyle disease, it is your fault. And so what they were doing, pairing a psychology that would be existent in the jury pool so that a jury would take their seats and all the tobacco company would have to do is build their case on an affirmative defense and say, look, it's a lifestyle disease. I mean, clearly cigarettes are bad, but they chose to smoke. And for the first 15 or so years of those product liability cases, the tobacco companies won most of them. It took some time for the population to change. The laws didn't change, but the population did. And then they started losing like crazy. So then what was their next move? To take that same playbook and move it into the food industry, to buy soft drink companies and food manufacturers, to put more addictive substances into those things, to put more sugar in because it triggers appetite, to add more caffeine, more stimulants, and to start referring to obesity and diabetes as lifestyle diseases.
I knew it. Yeah. It's just crazy because, you know, growing up, they're like, oh, pesticides on your food and this, that, and the other thing. And I was like, organic, that's a bunch of bullshit, like whatever. And then the more you're just looking at society, I think I saw something like this, 70% of the military is obese. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's...
The Pentagon issued some state alert, a state of emergency, because of the health of the general population is headed in a direction such that they will not be able to meet the recruiting goals for their requirement in the military. This is a serious problem. I'm only using the military because they measure stuff really well. But again, diabetes, a largely, and I mean largely, optional disease, type 2 that is going to cost America $400 billion this year. Like,
and this is something that you can easily, well, maybe not easily, but clearly solve through lifestyle modification. It's not, you know, we're going to get to the post-diabetic. I want a few questions before we get there. So the classic example in my life is I try to look at what's really happening in front of my eyes versus what society is telling me, because it tends to take me down the wrong path in many instances. And so my grandfather, my grandparents, they lived in the country, okay? And there was this farmer down the road, Blakey, that lived to his early 90s, eggs, bacon, same frying pan, and worked the farm every day, lived well into his 90s, okay? Based on everything that society tells us, he should have had a heart attack very early on based on that. So now I'm looking at it and saying a reasonable amount of salt, you know, butter and not, you know, these seed oils and all this shit. And the real one that messes with me is the butter and the cholesterol numbers. They're trying to push the cholesterol down to like 100 or something like that. And I'm like,
stop it.
Suck? No, but like there's got to be an issue there, right? And maybe you can expand on this.
There's an issue there. I'm just state some facts. I'm not going to suggest there's any correlation between these facts, but I'm just going to state facts. Cholesterol is a precursor for the manufacture of testosterone. North America currently seems to be waging a war on masculinity. Testosterone numbers are falling so rapidly in America that they're predicting that by 2050, most men will not be able to conceive naturally. There are certain forces at B that believe that we're headed for a population explosion and that would be dangerous rather than the population collapse we're headed for. Now, these are all just facts. They're just facts, but of course, they string along to, you know, to a number of potential conclusions. And one of the conclusions I would say is that by spotting a correlation between cholesterol and heart disease, which by the way was only ever correlative, it wasn't a causal relationship. I mean, there's a correlation between breathing and developing heart disease too. And so by spotting that correlation and then tying it to heart disease and then pushing people onto statins and artificially reducing their cholesterol levels, I think they're causing terrible harm and reducing testosterone. And I'm going to tell you something. As a man, you want to maximize your testosterone production as long as possible. You want to be in your 70s and still waking up. Well, you know what I was going to say.
Boing. Yeah, this is, I got to give credit to Gino because he was onto this stuff long before I was. And I was sort of like, oh, no. But then, you know, shit starts adding up. You start getting a little bit of fat. You start getting a little lazy. And you're like, what the hell? You start looking around going, everybody's a hippo. And how the hell is this happening? And then you look back to like the 1950s and the stuff you brought up, JFK and the initiatives there. It's a totally different world. And so, yeah. Just because I heard you mention it, I don't want to, I'd be, you know, feeling bad if we got through this without you describing a little bit the book that you just held up, but also Wild Fit. That's what you mentioned before. So you describe Wild Fit a little bit for us as well.
Yeah. So basically about 12 years ago, 15 years ago, I was teaching entrepreneurship and business around the world. I had a number of business workshops teaching entrepreneurship, marketing, that kind of stuff. And one thing that came up quite often for people is they talk about not having enough energy and procrastinating and, you know, getting sick and what have you. And so I started doing a one-hour bonus session, just speaking a little bit about nutritional anthropology and food psychology, because it had been a hobby of mine since I was 21 years old. At 21 years old, I was sick all the time, and I started doing, inspired, frankly, by Tony Robbins, I started looking into food a great deal. I tried a little food experiment. I lost 35 pounds. I cured all my ailments. I saved myself having surgery. And so I became a very impassioned student of health. And so years later, my business clients are asking me for advice about health. So I'm like, sure, I'll share it with you. But it frustrated me to do that because I would share it with them. And then I would see the same client 6 months later and they were no lighter. They were still sick. And I was like, but I gave you all the rules. And that's when I started doing some research into the diet industry itself. And I found out some things. Like the average person will go on two diets a year through their life. And they will gain roughly 3 pounds every time they do one. And they will damage their self-esteem and they'll hurt their psychology. And the diet industry is a deplorable clusterfuck. I mean, sorry, it's just not a good situation. And
it's
so
not
I thought,
sustainable.
It's a sustainable industry, not a sustainable
option for the humans consuming it. Yeah,
exactly. It's like a multi-billion dollar industry that is a multi-billion dollar industry because it doesn't work. So I then decided to dive into why it wasn't working. And I developed something called behavioral change dynamics, which is a series of principles and filters for the design of experience. So whether you're writing a book or preparing a speech or designing a retreat or an education program, it's a methodology for creating content that's engaging and sticky. And so what happens is that the first real job in making sure that you change somebody's life is that you actually get them to consume the content, right? Like it's no good if people buy the book and won't open it. You know, they won't read it. So we developed that program and launched it as a hobby. It was really a hobby. And the word of mouth was so powerful that we went from 150 clients a year to 5,000 clients a year to now over 100,000 clients around the world.
That's awesome.
And the stories started coming in where these clients kept coming to us and saying, you know, of course I've lost weight or my fertility is bad. I had babies that we'd given up. We didn't think we could have babies. Like really life-changing stories. This blows me away. Pretty much every day somebody writes something like that to me. But a very common one that we got was, I am now pre-diabetic. And I'm going to tell you something, that irritated me because they were saying they were type 2 diabetic and now they were pre, their doctor was calling them pre-diabetic. Well, pre means before or on the way to. It's basically a subliminal or let's say almost like placebo-like command. That
self-fulfilling prophecy, yeah.
And so I said snarkily one day to a client, just kidding around, I said, you're not pre-diabetic, you're post-diabetic.
I got that now. That's fantastic. I love
that. Yeah. But then it was a joke. But then one day I'm having a conversation with Mark Hyman. I don't know if you know Mark Hyman, the doctor, very, very well-recognized doctor. I think he was Bill Clinton's doctor at some stage. He's got a huge podcast. He's a great guy. I know him quite well. And he and I were having an interview. I was interviewing him for our Wild Fit members. And I mentioned this whole post-diabetic thing. And he goes, wait a minute. What are you talking about, Willis? Like, what is that? Yeah, you guys are old enough to know what I meant. So I explained it to him. And I said, well, what happens is somebody's type 2 diabetic. They improve their numbers. They improve their lifestyle, improve their numbers, and they become pre-diabetic. And that's wrong because pre-diabetic means they're still prescribable. You know, if you
and they're going in the wrong direction. Pre is before we get there.
Are prescribable.
Yeah.
And I would argue that if you're trending the other way, you shouldn't be prescribed anymore, or your prescription should at least be different. So I said, we call those people post-diabetic. And he goes, that's really good. And I said, then, even when they've improved their numbers all the way to remission, which they do, when they do that, they're still post-diabetic. Why? Because if you once achieved type 2 diabetes through your lifestyle, you have a propensity for it, and you need to be more cautious than the average person. So you are post-diabetic for life. You become post-diabetic the minute you've reversed out, and then you stay there. So Mark immediately is like, holy crap, can I use that? Like, he's like, would you mind if I use that? And I'm like, I hadn't even thought of his intellectual property. I said, yeah, go for it. But then I registered the .com and I wrote the book. But I want you to know something about the book that's really important. I'm not a doctor. And I resisted writing a book for a long time. I mean, what business do I have? Well, you see, my co-author here, Ruben, MD. Why is he my co-author? Well, one day I have a meeting in my calendar and I see it there. And I go on to the Zoom call and Ruben, my name is Eric. Nice to meet you. What are we here about? He goes, we need to talk. I said, what? And he tells me that in a single week, 4 months earlier, he'd been in two car accidents, both after stopping at Starbucks to get a coffee to wake himself up because he was so tired.
Yes.
Both cases, after drinking the coffee, he fell asleep and got into car accidents in a week. And at that, after the second accident, he had an entire crisis of conscience. He was like, how can I be a doctor? This is ridiculous. I'm 40 pounds overweight. I'm on 10 prescription medications. I'm type 2 diabetic. I'm hypertensive, and I'm supposed to be helping people? Google led him to me. Thank you, Sergey and the boys. But you know, Google led him to me, and he did one of our programs. Now, I knew nothing about this because it was a multimedia program. But he then told me that after 3 months, he'd lost 40 pounds, he'd reversed his type 2 diabetes and was post-diabetic, and he'd reversed his hypertension, and he got off 9 of his 10 meds. It took another 4 or 5 months to get off the 10th med. His entire life was transformed, and now he wanted to be a doctor again. And so he came to me and said, we got to get your message out into the world. And that's how the book came about. That's what we
have. Here's the thing too, gang. If you look at the current state of healthcare, I don't want to point the finger, but if you were going based on performance, the current doctor world is failing us. Their numbers are not great. So if that number was correct that we threw out, 70% of the military is overweight. There is very little attention to root causes and a high propensity to prescriptions. And that does not seem to be serving humans well. So there's a problem at the end of the day.
There is a problem. And yeah. I don't want to throw doctors under the bus. It's not actually.
It's a little robotic though. Like, you know, I hear you.
Their education was hijacked by drug interests. So, you know, they can spend 6 years in medical school and not study food at all. That's a shocking reality. And most of them don't realize that until you point out something. Holy crap, I never thought of that. But I'll tell you that doctors, with respect to diabetes, obviously other lifestyle conditions as well, but with respect to diabetes, doctors fall into basically three camps. There are doctors that are well aware that type 2 diabetes is a fully reversible condition. It can take 10 or 15 years to create it and 9 weeks to reverse it. There are doctors that know that and they're impassioned about it. And they work with their clients on turning around. Many of them have come to us for training on this. So there's that class, but they are the smallest piece of the pie. Then there's another larger group of doctors. They are aware that it's optional. They're aware that it's reversible, but they have no idea how to get people to make the change. They tell people, they give them the pamphlet. They're like, look, you're on the diabetic spectrum. You're pre-diabetic. You're headed toward diabetes. But what they don't do is tell people the truth about that. Look, you're likely going to lose your eyesight. You're going to lose an arm or a leg to amputation. You're massively increasing your odds of getting heart disease or cancer. And lo and behold, if another pandemic comes through, you're going to be first on the list. Like, those viruses are terrible if you're immunocompromised like that. They don't tell them all that stuff. And then they give them a pamphlet and say, eat more of this and eat less of that. And often the food guidelines that they were given were provided by the food industry.
Mm-hmm.
So then the clients don't use their willpower and don't change. So those doctors give up and just prescribe medicine. And then the third category of doctors are the very old school ones that came straight out of pharmacology, and they don't even believe that diabetes is reversible. Of course, that group is now starting to come around.
Man, you have great vitality. I'll say that. I really enjoyed this. I truly enjoyed the food discussion. Gino, you prepared to take us home?
I just want to give Eric, I'd be remiss if I didn't tell Eric how Jake and I met. And Jake makes it seem as if, oh, it's wonderful now. We met in 2009. I had four children at the time. My wife had just given birth to our fourth child at home. We were eating organic and we were homeschooling our kids. So when I met Jake, Jake was working for GlaxoSmithKline as a drug rep.
I was on the dark side and I've since found
out. So can you imagine, like, and he really didn't say anything and I didn't push my beliefs. We just got along really well.
Selling diabetes medication to give. I'm not going to go any further with that, but there was some issues.
So if there's hope for Jake, there is hope for anyone on this podcast. And the one thing that I did, I never told Jake, you've got to eat organic. You've got to do this. You've got to do that. I lived my life according to what I believed and what I thought, because I was influenced heavily by my father-in-law, Dr. Phil Maffetone. You should go check him out. He's been doing this for 40 years. I mean, he can tell you sugar is the number one problem we have on this planet. That for fair. I'm carbohydrate intolerant, so I need to be careful. But if there's hope for Jake, there is hope for all of us. Right, Jake? Would you say that's accurate? And I do want to really recap Eric's life in this next 30 seconds. It's really hard to recap a life that started in South Africa, went to Canada. At 15 years old, he's homeless. His father kicks him out. He probably has the very same genes as my daughter, Veronica. Probably want to kill him because he's so damn stubborn. Would you just listen to me for 3 seconds? That's why he's an amazing entrepreneur, because he doesn't listen to anybody. He listens to his heart. He has passion. He's authentic. That's what makes Eric an amazing human being. He didn't stop with his first business selling out. He didn't stop with WildFit. He didn't stop becoming, you know, just an amazing speaker. He's also got this book that's coming out, The Evolution Gap. Go out and buy it. And if you do want to become an amazing speaker, and I think we should all become leaders and all be able to communicate with others. Go check out Eric at The Speaker Nation as well. Thanks, Eric.
Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure, guys.
Gino just cranked it up, gang. And as always, hey, we believe in buying deals for the long term. Think in decades. I'm Jake. He is the G-Daddy. Let me make it happen. We'll see you next time. Thanks, Eric.